Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A suicide bomber is quite possibly the most dangerous weapons delivery system on Earth, capable of last-second decisions, maximizing destruction, and evading detection. It was long thought that suicide bombers needed to be recruited and almost hypnotized to act. They fit a certain profile, young, lone men with a history of activism or instability who could be programmed to die for their cause. Now the bombers are getting younger as 14. They're not loners, they're mainstream. They volunteer or even act alone. The phenomenon is stunning Israel, even Palestinians, and increasingly citizens and security agencies around the world. But what, if anything, can be done to stop suicide attacks? Bruce Hoffman is director of RAND Corporation's Washington office and the author of Inside Terrorism. I asked him about the surging reality of suicide bombing.
I think what's happened in recent months is that we've seen a transformation, particularly in Israel and Palestine, of something that was a relatively isolated phenomenon to something that's really taken on the trappings of a mass movement.
What does it mean when suicide bombing becomes a mass movement?
In the past, I think there was a problem in that the terrorist organizations actually had some difficulty in recruiting suicide bombers. They had, as it were, talent spotters that looked for people that were economically, on the skids, that were somehow, emotionally bereft or abject, who in other words were susceptible to being induced and then indoctrinated to become suicide bombers. Unfortunately, what we've seen in recent months is individuals from entire strata of Palestinian society, teenagers, parents, the gainfully employed. In fact, two of the recent suicide bombers have been sons of millionaires, poor people, bus drivers, even women stepping forward and now volunteering almost en masse to become suicide bombers.
How do you interpret this psychologically? What produces such a wave of even volunteers?
Well, I think it's certainly the a concatenation of circumstances. On the one hand, I believe the desperation that many feel with the breakdown of the Israeli-Palestinian peace accords back in July 2000, the slide into violence. Obviously, there are socioeconomic factors that play into it. But also, too, it's, I think, amongst the terrorists, at least, and indeed many of the people they're attracting, there's a belief that suicide terrorism works, that this is the one weapon that is amazingly potent and amazingly powerful when unleashed against one's enemies.
One of the groups that has apparently been involved in recruiting and training suicide bombers in the past, Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, has now come forward and say they're forbidding adolescents to act on their own, as if they're stepping up, they're volunteering and doing it on their own, and I guess there's been evidence of that. What do you make of a group like Hamas now saying, whoa, enough?
Well, look, you have a situation where in the aftermath of suicide attacks, parents, rather than lamenting the death of a son, or at least in two instances a daughter, are actually saying how proud they are and saying that this is a good thing and saying that they hope their other children go forward. So it creates a culture, an almost inverted reality, where death becomes more important than life, in essence. So I don't think it's surprising that teenagers, who are often at the, the sharp end of the spear of various counterterrorism or security measures, are stepping forward and seeking to emulate their elders. I mean, children throughout the world do this. I mean, they follow what their parents tell them, in essence. I think in Hamas's case is that this has nothing to do with any sense of morality or any second thoughts or crisis of conscience. Rather, it's a very cynical move. They understand that this tactic, if it continues using teenagers, is likely to alienate their constituency, that is the Palestinian people, and reverse this mass movement phenomena where suicide bombing has become very acceptable and very popular, but have a backlash, and they're just seeking to prevent the backlash.
You said it's become a very powerful weapon. I guess if there's no problem in recruiting volunteers and the supply is more or less infinite, or seems so lately, what kind of weapon system is this?
First and foremost, it's a very potent psychological weapon. What it's designed to do is break down the trust that holds society together. It's designed to make the target population believe that they're unsafe, even to go around the corner to buy groceries, not just to go out to a restaurant or go to a cinema or go shopping in a mall, but that even something as basic as buying food is now become dangerous. So it's a very powerful psychological weapon, and it's really designed not only to erode this trust so people become fearful, paranoid, they shut themselves in, become xenophobic, but also to undermine confidence in government and political leadership, and thereby to create a climate that the terrorists believe they can manipulate and exploit and essentially get that society to capitulate to the terrorists' will.
What about suicide bombing in practical terms as a delivery system for destruction? How does it compare with alternatives if it's easy to arrange?
Well, not only is it easy to arrange, and especially if you have plastic explosives, you could put small amounts of explosives that have an exponential, explosive power that actually kill lots of people and are very unobtrusive. But also, logistically, it's a very simple operation. You don't have to worry about the escape. You just have to get the bomber to the target. The bomber can make decisions that can affect the targeting, so make whatever tactical adjustments need to be made along the way. And obviously, if you have someone willing to surrender their life, the whole rationale is that they're using their bodies to get as close to their target as possible. So it's very difficult to defend against.
Is there a new body of thinking developing on how best to defend against suicide bombing?
There is, but it's really in response. It's what's happening. It's emerging very quickly in response to the change in suicide bombing. As we were just discussing a minute ago, when it was a handful of people in a more isolated phenomena, much of the focus was on individual pathologies and therefore psychiatric and psychological interventions designed to address why an individual becomes a suicide bomber. The problem now is, as this is metastasized, as it's become much more of a mass movement, that itself will be inadequate. We have to look not only at that, but I think even more so at strategies and tactics that affect the organization that are recruiting and marshaling and then deploying the suicide bombers.
What kind of strategy? You could look at Ariel Sharon's description of the Israeli invasion of the West Bank in the past few weeks. He said they went in to take out the infrastructure of terrorism. Is that what you're talking about? That kind of action?
Well, certainly that's part of it, but that's only one part. I think certainly neutralizing the terrorist infrastructure, basically preventing the logisticians, the intelligence operatives, the bomb makers themselves from having the ability to deploy the suicide bombers is one step. I think the most important thing, though, is almost an organizational, a societal intervention, where on the organizational side, you demonstrate that suicide bombing is a losing tactic that will alienate precisely your constituents, that is not a solution to these sorts of problems. And on the other hand, I think societally, that creates a new sense of reality where suicide bombing all of a sudden isn't acceptable and isn't tolerated and isn't venerated. You don't have a situation where parents are saying that they'd like other children to become suicide bombers.
This sounds much more difficult than taking out an airport or a nuclear weapons facility even. You have to get into the heart of a society.
You do. And you have to do it on a number of different levels, as I said, from the individual to the organization behind the individual suicide bomber to the entire society as well.
The United States has seen suicide bombing on a large scale last September, obviously, but we haven't seen on American soil the kind of thing that's happened all over Israel at this point. Is this an Israel-only problem, or is this an exportable weapon?
I wouldn't see it as an Israel-only problem. Already in the United States in 1997, for example, a Lebanese and a Palestinian individual living in Brooklyn, New York, plotted to stage a suicide attack on the New York City subway system. Certainly we have the events from September 11th where there were suicide attacks. I think the problem is whenever you find a tactic like this that seems to work, that almost the sophistication is in its simplicity, the attraction will be quite wide. So I'm not necessarily sure there's an imminent threat in the United States, but it's certainly prudent to anticipate that this is something that could become more commonplace here.
Bruce Hoffman, top level, what kind of posture can the United States and other countries have to discourage suicide bombing? What kind of strategic posture might invite it?
Well, I think often the suicide bombing takes root irrespective necessarily of what governments are doing. It's that the terrorists, the people behind it, see it as a particularly lucrative tactic in that it will work. Already there's been statements from senior al-Qaeda leaders saying that just as Hamas has found a potent weapon or the Palestinian terrorists against Israel who value life so much that he made the same comparison with the United States in September 11th.
Do you think that the U.S. would be as vulnerable as Israel to this tactic? It's a much bigger country.
Well, it's less the size. I mean, the breadth and the size of the United States means that it's much more difficult to defend every conceivable target against these types of attacks. Rather, I think the difference is in Israel, because of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, there are, you know, contiguous geographical areas where the suicidal terrorists are recruited, where they're, whatever modicum of training they receive, they're given, and when they're primed and deployed. Here it would be, I think, more difficult.
More difficult to recruit people, to deploy people?
I think both. I mean, you don't have the sense of desperation and the sense of conflict on a daily basis that so envelops society in Israel that exists in the United States, and that's a very powerful draw and attraction for suicidal terrorists. I mean, they're living under violence all the time, so it doesn't seem like such a huge leap now to engage in some dramatic acts of violence that involves their own person. I think, though, it's the logistical infrastructure. I mean, don't forget there's been suicide bombings in Israel since 1994. It's not a new phenomenon.
Do you have any sense that Israel is now turning the corner on this problem, or is it still significantly at risk?
Well, I think it's turning the corner. Don't forget there was an average of 3 suicide attacks per month between the start of Intifada II in September 2000 and the third week of March of this year. What happened is in that last week of March, there were 8 attacks in 7 days. Now, one could say that I don't think there's many societies in the world that could bear 3 suicide attacks a month, not least the United States. But Israel, that was still something they could bear. When it became more than one a day is when, obviously, they moved with the military action in the West Bank. And we see the fruit of it. I mean, there's no one who thinks that there's a complete solution to terrorism that says anything you can do to completely stop it. But we see that the incidence of suicide bombing has decreased. There's only been 2 since the military options began, which isn't perfect, but it's certainly better than one a day.
Bruce Hoffman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bruce Hoffman is director of RAND Corporation's Washington office and the author of Inside Terrorism. Suicide bombing in Israel has been shockingly on the rise in recent months, peaking just before last month's Israeli invasion of the West Bank. This hour, we're taking a sober look at the psychology and circumstances of suicide bombers. 9/11 brought suicide bombing to America, but the frequency of attacks keeps growing. Why are more young people choosing death, and what can be done to deter them? How do you decommission a human bomb? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us in the studio tonight is Palestinian psychiatrist Iyad Sarraj. He's founder and director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in the Gaza Strip. He's secretary general of the Independent Palestinian Commission for Citizens' Rights. Good evening and welcome, Iyad Sarraj.
Good evening to you. Pleasure to be with you.
Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our on-point news analyst, Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Iyad Sarraj, what is happening? How has the profile of a suicide bomber changed in Israel, in coming out of the Palestinian communities in the last year, in the last 6 months? How's the profile of the typical bomber changing?
Well, I think the typical bomber is still a typical bomber. What is happening sometimes is that there are some exceptions to the rule, but the typical suicide bomber, or a martyr as we call it, is a Palestinian who is desperate. Palestinian who has seen or subjected to humiliation in a systematic manner, a Palestinian who has been subjected to injustice treatment, a Palestinian who in his childhood has witnessed or been a victim of an act of violence directed against him or his elders, like witnessing the father being beaten in front of his eyes, or his elder brother tortured, and so on. This is the typical personality, plus that usually they are timid, they are people who are insecure and very secretive, and in their last few weeks of life, usually become very nice to the people around them, and people glorify them when they die.
We want to come in much more detail to your psychiatric analysis, but when you call suicide bombers martyrs, as a psychiatrist, are you endorsing suicide bombing?
No, I am, as a psychiatrist, as a human rights activist and peace activist, I completely object to these acts of violence, and I believe they are horrific and they are inhuman, and I'm completely opposed to it. But however, I'm trying to understand. I'm trying also to put the message across to the people to understand why.
We're talking this hour about suicide bombing. It's reached epidemic proportions in this last season in Israel. Can you imagine what goes on inside the mind of a suicide bomber? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about suicide bombing. It has reached historically unparalleled levels in Israel over the last several months as Palestinians have poured out of the West Bank to die, bombing, and killing in Israel. Can you imagine what goes on in the mind of the suicide bomber? What is the best response to suicide bombing? What's the best defense? What is the best cure? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Eyad Saraj. He's a psychiatrist, a Palestinian, and founder and director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in the Gaza Strip. Eyad Saraj, I'm struck in your very first response when we ask about or talk about suicide bombing. You're a psychiatrist. You have a medical background. You understand that aspect of human character. And yet your response is largely political. It must be difficult for you to pull apart or to distinguish at this point between, the pathology of the suicide impulse and the political. Are you able to separate these things in your own mind at this point?
Well, you see, the people are the product of the environment in which they live in. There is nothing happening in isolation. Suicide bombing is only a symptom. And the disease is the Israeli military occupation and what has happened to the Palestinian psyche over the last 35 years of that occupation.
But there are many ways to respond to what's taken as an offense. Suicide bombing seems to be much more the hallmark of this particular conflict than in any other I can think of. Why?
Well, see, I take your point. Of course, from a Palestinian point of view, we asked the world to help us, and they did. The United Nations passed resolution after resolution demanding Israel to withdraw and to give the Palestinians the right of self-determination. But nothing happened. The Palestinians tried the armed struggle against the Israeli occupation. For a long time, it did not work. Then Israel started to use far superior power, including the F-16 and the Apache and the tanks and so on, to the extent that Palestinians became so desperate militarily, after being so desperate politically and psychologically. And so, as the previous guest said, death became equal to life, because the notion today is death in dignity is better than life in humiliation.
You've written, and this I found very striking, because you've put this in ethnic terms in a way that I think most Americans would be loath to. You've written that shame is the most painful emotion in the Arab culture, producing the feeling that one is unworthy to live. The honorable Arab is the one who refuses to suffer shame and dies in dignity. How does this jive with psychiatry? It sounds like a kind of racial stereotyping. Or how do you put these things together?
Well, you see, we live in Arab culture. We live in the Middle East, which is Arab culture. And you don't begin to become a psychiatrist or a psychologist without understanding that culture. I was educated in the West, yes, but all my education has to do in the culture I'm living in now, which is the Arab culture. So understanding that is very important. Even understanding the political situation is very important to understand the Arab psyche. Now, in the West, you feel guilty sometimes of things. We feel ashamed if we do something wrong. That is very powerful emotion. And without understanding the difference between guilt and shame, you do not begin even to understand Arabs.
Is shame more likely to produce the suicide bombing response than guilt?
Well, let me tell you something. If you kill me now, my family is obliged to kill you to take revenge, right? Unless, and if they don't do, they will live in shame.
You're saying this is a cultural tradition?
It is the honor. It is the honor of the family to do it. And they will only stop if your family comes forward and say, we are sorry, we acknowledge our guilt, and we are ready to take the responsibility of the action of our son. And by the same honor, my family would have to say, yes, we accept that. So honor and shame are very important in understanding the Arab culture.
So we have anthropology and psychiatry all mixed together here. And I want to bring Jack Beattie in, but one question first. What about the problem of murder that is at the other end of this act? Is it not perceived that it might, in fact, push the goal, if it's, let's say, a Palestinian state? It might push it farther away because Israelis are so freaked out at people being killed, civilians being killed in grocery stores, in markets, in their, that they can't have any trust. Where does the sense of comprehension of that fact come in?
Absolutely, I agree with you. I believe that suicide bombing, in fact, every Palestinian bullet has politically hurt the Palestinians more than anything. First, it has brought Sharon into the power, and it became a prime minister of Israel. It has given him the justification to put aside all the question of the Palestinian statehood, and it has given him the excuse to continue to settle the Palestinian land by Israeli settlers. So, politically speaking, we have radicalized the Israelis in fear, right? And we did not achieve anything from this political violence. My point of view to my Palestinian people is use nonviolence. This is the stay on the higher moral ground. You will achieve your political aims of justice, of Palestinian sovereignty, and the end of the Israeli occupation much better than using any forms of violence.
And yet, Jack Beattie, we have not seen a whole lot of evidence, certainly lately, that that's the way things are going in Israel and the Palestinian territories there.
No, and we seem to be seeing that the leadership is slipping from the hands of the Palestinian Authority and into the hands of these suicide bombers. Just over the weekend, Chairman Arafat had to cancel his visit to Jenin because the platform where he was going to speak was burned, and there was even a rumor that his car was shot at. And Jenin, of course, is a place where Islamic Jihad is the main, they're the heroes of the hour. And people there interviewed by the Jerusalem Post were saying, we don't want Arafat. He's not our leader anymore. Our leader, and they mentioned an Islamic Jihad leader, and I'm sure this kind of thing could be repeated in Gaza. So I'm just wondering, Doctor, is this sort of happening, that the dreadful charisma given out by these bombers and their fiendish runners, that this is sort of becoming the new politics, the center of Palestinian life?
Well,
there are
three players in the game. One is Yasser Arafat, who I think is proved to be a failure. There is the extremists on Palestinian side, which are these Islamists. And then you have the extremists represented by Sharon. And I believe the extremists now are feeding each other. They need each other to stay in power on both sides. And Arafat is squeezed out of the game now. And I think the Palestinian population and the Israeli population who deserve much better are now squeezed between the two extremes.
Iyad Siraj, Jack Beattie, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Scott Anderson. He's a contributor to the New York Times Magazine and author of a wonderful article there this weekend, very sobering, called An Impossible Occupation. Good evening and welcome, Scott Anderson.
Good evening.
Scott, you've spent a lot of time with Israeli soldiers as they attempt to bring some security. You've heard Iyad Siraj describing the circumstances that, from his perspective, create the suicide bomber. Do you see any way out of this loop, this growing cycle of suicide violence?
I really don't. And I think that even as some of the soldiers I was with in the West Bank, they saw that what the Israeli offensive was doing was just stoking the flames for the next wave to come. You know, and they pointed out, and someone earlier in the program said that, you know, during the month of April, you saw a big decrease in suicide bombings. And that I think that everyone there felt that it was largely a result that you had 20,000 Israeli troops on the ground. What happens when those troops go back into their barracks or in the reservist case are decommissioned? The border with the West Bank is extremely porous. It's very easy to come across.
You describe these very tough elite Israeli soldiers being shocked by what they found in schools in the West Bank, classroom walls papered with posters of Palestinian suicide bombers, martyrs, in classrooms where 5- and 6-year-olds would be educated.
Right. It It was in the West Bank city of Tulkarm when they seized it in the first couple of days of the offensive, and in the primary school there on the classroom walls were the pictures of the Shahids, the martyrs, and it was interesting. I was with these commandos for a week, and it came up again and again, with anger, but also with more astute soldiers, a sense of this is what we're up against now, and this is something fundamentally different than we were facing even a year ago. And as the first gentleman on the program talked about, what you're seeing among the suicide bombers is this really dramatic change in the past year. A year ago, I mean, speaking in generalities, the suicide bombers tended to be young men in their 20s who had long experience with militancy, and now you're seeing, I mean, literally high school kids.
Very young. We've seen age 14, age 15, age 16, and often, lately, not organized by anyone, just spontaneously running with a pipe bomb at Israeli soldiers or an Israeli settlement. Iyad Siraj, what is the psychological factor here? Are they, of course, there's a political environment, and you describe it, in all of its pain, and pain for both sides. But psychologically, is it this early anti-Israel education that is apparently part of the Palestinian schooling that prepares children to see the Israeli target as a dehumanized figure that they can kill as they kill themselves without remorse?
Look, I was brought up in Gaza, and I went to the schools in Gaza up to the high school before going to university. I was never taught at school to hate Jews, but the message was there all the time, all the way around you. The message of the Israeli occupation, it tells you that you are less than a human being. You don't need curriculum books to tell you how to hate Israelis and Jews, because the message is there. I was lucky enough to be exposed to the rest of the world and to see that there are Jews who are equal human beings to me. But the rest of the population of the Palestinians in Gaza today in the refugee camps do not know of Israel except an Israeli soldier with a machine gun and a screaming voice and a humiliating nature. And they tell them all the time, systematically, that they are not equal human beings. You don't need textbooks to hate Jews then.
But they also have the textbooks.
They don't have textbooks to hate you. No, I tell you, they don't. But of course, on the other side, people and children particularly need symbols of power. You know what happened during the first Intifada? We were allowing children to play to express their trauma and so on. And there is a very
stone
popular
throwing.
Game. There's a popular game called Arabs and Jews. Right?
On the West Bank, in Gaza.
In Gaza. And many Palestinian children prefer to play the role of the Jew.
Why? Why?
Because he represented power for them at the time. Power is very important for children to identify with. Mm. Today, seriously and tragically, the children today find in the martyr as a symbol of power. And that is very serious.
A lot of callers want to join us. Let's welcome them in. Victor's on the line. Welcome, Victor. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Great show.
Thank you.
One thing I would say is that the thing in the classrooms, and even before that, for at least 50 years, there's been nothing but anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic propaganda in the Arab media, even to this day. And you know, the repeating the discredited Elders of Zion thing and so on. And
mm-hmm.
I don't think there can be peace until the media in the Arab world start and the Palestinian world begins to the people to do that. Instead, they've spent 50 years preparing them the other way.
Victor, let's put it to our guest, and thank you for your call. Scott Anderson, we've heard Iyad Siraj on this point. Can you draw some kind of distinction between what's taught and what's simply perceived in the environment as motivations to suicide bombing?
Well, I would largely agree with Mr. Siraj. I think there is a culture of in the West Bank and in Gaza that you are constantly under the thumb of the Israeli forces. And you know, it was interesting, the commandos I was with, they sort of pride themselves on, when they do raids or when they do checkpoints, that they treat people as humanely as possible. But you know, it doesn't sort of, if you, you know, you hand out candy to the children in the houses you raid, or you, you know, you try not to humiliate the father in front of the children, it's still, you're still an occupying force. And again, you know, the more kind of knowledgeable or the more astute commandos that I was with were very aware of this, and they felt very morally conflicted by it.
You portrayed the commandos very sympathetically, I'd say, but I was struck by how you had them saying opposite things. On the one hand, you quote one saying, you know, I've spent 20 years of my life fighting the Arabs. The only way to get their respect, we have to defeat them, and maybe then they'll want peace, is to defeat them. Just a couple of pages later, it says, you know, this isn't about winning. We cannot win this war.
Right. And, you know, and it's funny, the commander you quoted at the beginning who said, you know, the only thing the Arabs understand is force, and we have to beat them. He came around at the end of this week that I was with him, and said, you know, the only way out of this is a Palestinian state. And he characterized himself as the most right-wing member of the platoon, and he said there's just no other way out of this. There needs to be a Palestinian state, It was interesting that was almost universal. In fact, it was universal among the commanders I was with. That the only way out of this situation now is separation.
Iyad Sarraj, there are many things standing between where the world is now and a Palestinian state, obviously. One of them appears to be a fear among Israelis that even if there's a state, this kind of activity might continue. You describe the elixir of power that martyrdom has come to represent. How can the world, how can Israel have confidence that once a Palestinian state is established, this kind of attack won't continue?
Absolutely. I want Israel to feel secure and in peace. And the only way for Israel to feel secure and in peace is, first, we have to get rid of the Israeli occupation. Second, we have to put all the guarantees that Israel asks for as security. Third, a peace process that will end up with the establishment of a Palestinian state that is democratic, that is monitored, that is respecting the rule of law. This was the failure, the most important failure of Yasser Arafat in the last 7 years, that he did not start the process of building a Palestinian state.
But imagine that all of that is achieved, and that's monumental in itself. But imagine all that achieved, there are still people who have taken a bite of this terrible apple here, who have seen that suicide bombing can strike fear, panic into Israel. How can Israelis have confidence, even if all this is granted, that this won't go on, that hardliners, as you put it, won't continue to push the suicide button?
Let me tell you, during the last 7 years, it was a recorded observation that the popular support of suicide bombing and violence in general had to do with the amount of despair. Whenever there is hope, there is less support. I want Palestinian people to feel dignified enough in their own state to be able to protect peace with their own soul rather than encouraging violence. That is the only solution. When I feel that I can protect peace with my own life rather than die today in honor or in humiliation.
We're talking about suicide bombing. We saw it on 9/11. Today, Israel and the Palestinians have seen a lot of it in the last 6 months. How do you characterize these suicide volunteers? How do we find the off switch for suicide bombing? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the mentality, the psychology of suicide bombing. It has reached enormous proportions in Israel in the last 6 months. It only continues to grow, a fall off since the Israeli invasion of the West Bank, but no one is confident that that is the end of it. How do we find the off switch for suicide bombing? How do you characterize these suicide volunteers? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Iyad Sarraj, a Palestinian psychiatrist who works in the Gaza Strip, by Scott Anderson, whose detailed story of Israeli soldiers on security detail in the West Bank appeared in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Jack Beatty, you hear the conversation. It's political, it's psychiatry, it's psychology, all mixed up in a bundle, and it's hard to find the thread that's going to pull this one apart.
It certainly is, but the doctor says that the cause of this is humiliation, and the cure is to end the humiliation. And that jibes pretty closely with what Graham Allison was saying at Harvard a couple of weeks ago in a colloquium they did on terrorism, and they had a number of experts. And the point he made was that terrorism is a phenomenon that springs from failed states, states that can't exert authority within their own borders or that don't care to. And that very logic would say to me that the Israelis' best hope is to have a successful state and to do everything in their power to create a successful Palestinian state to deal with this undeterrable problem that springs from the failed state, the occupied state that these people live in.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
And Scott Anderson, the Israeli soldiers, and of course that you spent time with, of course these are mainly reservists, so they are Israeli citizens as well. How do you see them wrestling with the two sides of this? On the one hand, the impulse to crack down with all the strength they've gotten. On the other, is there this sense that the best way to the light might in fact be to develop and embrace a strong Palestinian neighbor?
I think very much the latter. It was interesting with these commandos, and they were all reservists, and in some cases they were in their early 40s, so they've been fighting and being called up for 22, 23 years. What I heard again and again was we showed up this time because things had gotten so bad. There have been so many suicide bombings in the last few months that something had to be done. We had to do something, but by doing something, also sort of a lot of them had the feeling that maybe we were just making the problem worse. No one I talked to, and the most sort of right-wing supporter of Sharon among the commandos, no one thought that this offensive was going to somehow solve the problem. And what they talked about it again and again was, all we can hope to do with this offensive is to create this sort of peaceful space, and hopefully the politicians on both sides will use that space to start talking. And the one guy who was sort of the main character of my piece, he gave this sort of warning at the end of it, where he said, you know, what Sharon has to understand is we've now created this space for them to talk. If they don't talk, If they waste this space, a lot of us are not going to come back.
Suraj, let me let you in here.
And yet the same Likud people yesterday passed a resolution that made Sharon even look like a dove.
I know.
By saying that there is no way for a Palestinian state. So they obstructed hope. You see, suicide bombing is, I think it is something between desperation and hope. The difference between humiliation and dignity, injustice and justice, disease and health, failure and success. If you have the first category, first line,
all
then
the
you
negatives.
End up with the suicide bombing. If you take the other one, it means peace for Israel and for the Palestinians. And I believe, let me say this, please, that Israel is today, and the Palestinians are squeezed in the hands of extremists, and Israel needs somebody now to rescue itself from itself.
And the Palestinians the
and
same?
And the Palestinians, because Palestinian liberation will only come when Israel is liberated.
Rebecca's on the line. Welcome, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I think your questions that you've asked are great. You've asked all the probing questions that I would have wanted to ask.
Oh, give us one more.
I have several more. Mr. Siraj said that the textbooks aren't being used, and actually Peter Herman had an article last December, www.edu.me.org. There are explanations of the textbooks listing, you know, talking about suicide bombers as martyrs, saying that Palestinians need to have a lot of children as a demographic weapon against Israel.
So you're saying that, in fact, there are materials in the Palestinian classrooms that are anti-Israel.
The children.
That's certainly been widely reported.
Yes.
It was in the Baltimore Sun.
Yeah, yeah. Understood, Rebecca. And what else is on your mind?
Oh, well, just the Children's Circle also, which is like Sesame Street, has children singing about suicide bombings and being martyrs.
Yeah.
It changes the culture. I think the world needs to say, whether it's in Palestinians or elsewhere in the world, you can't do that. You can't teach your children that. That's child abuse, to raise your children from 4 and 5 years old to want to die.
Rebecca, well, it's a potent point.
Let me tell you that if you are a Palestinian child who lives in one of the refugee camps next to an Israeli settlement,
yes,
and the child is poorly nourished, that he suffers from chronic malnutrition, mm-hmm, he looks across, there is a very nice place like California on the beach, which Israeli settlers enjoy. And what kind of message this child is getting from this Israeli settlement? That he is not an equal human being, and these are the human beings. So what do you want him to express? Love and respect? No. He will first express disgust to himself and shame to his father, and why we are brought into this life, father, it is better for us to do something about it. Why, father, you're not doing it? Why my father are not carrying a gun? Why didn't you shoot at the Israelis? This is what the Israeli settlers' message to the Palestinian children. It is a message that you are not equal human being. And in that respect, you didn't need people to teach you. And as for the textbooks and so on, I have a map in my house in Gaza, in which Palestine is mandatory Palestine.
All of Israel and the West Bank.
Is that an offense? Mm-hmm. You have that map in Israel. This is all Israel for you. But that does not mean incitement. I want peace. I want peace. I want guarantee that the Israelis will have peace as much as I will have peace. But if you change the environment of that child, then you ask the child, why are you doing suicide bombing? But today you are putting him in a position in which the only way out of this despair is to kill and die. And this is the symbol of life and honor and so on. And you tell him, don't do it. Well, give him food, give him a job, give him a decent house, give him dignity, give him his land. And then tell him, now you are an ordinary and equal human citizen, equal citizen. I'm going to apply the rule of law. So you will have to respect the rule of law.
Rebecca, how do you respond to that? There's a lot more going on there than some angry textbook lines.
I think that the Palestinians do need hope. I think they do need jobs. But they're not living under Israeli rule. They're living under Palestinian rule, PA rule. The UNRWA runs the camps. So if there's poor conditions there, you can ask Arafat and the UNRWA where the international money has gone.
Yad Siraj?
I tell you, I live in Gaza, and I have a British passport, and I have also a Palestinian ID. But it's only because I have a British passport I was allowed to leave Gaza, which is supposedly to be under the Palestinian Authority. But I cannot leave Gaza without an Israeli military permit, even being a British citizen. This is the life of Gaza. Gaza is under the occupation. 40% of the land of Gaza now is taken for the enjoyment of 4,000 Israeli settlers, while the rest of us, 1,200,000, have to live on the rest of the land. Why is that? This is totally unfair, and it produces the feelings of hatred and inequality. The only way to change this is by facing the facts. The fact is, the West Bank and Gaza are under the Israeli illegal occupation, and that has to end.
Rebecca, thank you for your call. Tom is calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Tom.
Hi. Okay, 9 a.m. tomorrow morning in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, Ariel Sharon gets on national television before the parliament, whatever, televised, says, we are returning to pre-June 5th, 1967 borders, number one. Number two, we are going to deal with the right of return fairly and justly. And number three, we're going to deal with resource issues so they're no longer a problem. Right away, I guarantee you, all the violence, all of this martyrdom stuff, it will end because it'll all dry up.
Are you absolutely confident of that, Tom?
I bet my own life. I'm so sure that I bet my own life on it.
Tom,
what's
your investment in this struggle?
My investment is a humanitarian one. I'm a human being. You know, you see this stuff happening just as bad as you feel for what the Jews and the Gypsies and the homosexuals and the others went through, Slavs and the rest, during the Second World War under Hitler. You see the same thing happening in that part of the world, and you feel just as bad. It's horrible. The same thing that happened in East Timor and in other parts. I mean, you see it happening there. It's injustice. It's wrong. And it's so simple to end. I mean, that's the most frustrating thing. The solution is such a simple and obvious one. Just
Absolutely.
Go back to June 5th, deal with the right of return, deal with resource, and it's over. They have nothing to argue and struggle for afterwards because they accept Israel otherwise.
Tom, thank you for your call. And yes, it's easy to describe it in simple terms, but we've seen powerful people spend a lot of time trying to get to something near that solution and fail time and again. Scott Anderson Can you imagine that somehow out of the space that this most recent incursion has created, to use your word and the soldier's word, out of Ariel Sharon's well-known reputation as a conservative, that some kind of radical solution could come forth? Or are we bound to just endlessly, you know, walk around this same bloody circle?
Well, it's interesting. I've never been an optimist about this situation in the Middle East, but I'm kind of weirdly an optimist now. In that, I think things have gotten so bad so quickly that there is a general realization that the status quo can't remain. One thing I was really struck by coming back this time was how few Israelis. Even on the far right, we're still talking about the creation of a greater Israel, of basically annexing the West Bank and turning it into Israel. No one except the extreme right wing, religious right wing, talks about that anymore. What's fascinating that's developing in Israel now is this talk of, and it goes across the spectrum from left to right wing, of building a wall. Basically, sort of the Cyprus solution of just creating a green line all the way, and separating Palestine and Israel. Of course, where the fight becomes is the left is saying we should go back to the 67 border, and the right is saying, yeah, except we need to include the settlements.
So where do you build that wall is the question. Yad Siraj, what about that? If a wall goes up, is that a solution to suicide bombing in the conflict?
Well, you see, I believe that the whole land should be a country for all people where they are enjoying equal human rights.
You're saying not two states, but one?
I believe strongly that the way for the Israelis and the Palestinians is to live there as equal human beings, whether Christian or Muslim. Or
in Jewish. One state?
In one state.
But you know Israelis are terrified of that because they become a minority in their own country.
If both camps, if the Jews and if the Palestinians want to have a national state, then let's be it. Let it be. And let us hope that one day, after so many decades in peace and security, they will join together and become one state, because I don't believe in religious states.
Scott Anderson, response?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of a wonderful idea. I think it's probably quite unrealistic, given how polarized both sides are now.
But this is the vision for the future.
It's a vision.
Right.
I want to put a last question to you, Iyad Siraj. You have written that your own sister, sitting with you one day watching television, the scenes of violence, said to you she was ready to become a martyr. In her words, that means suicide bomber. Is she still?
No, I luckily called her today from Boston, and she's fine. But she is very desperate again, because the situation today in Gaza after the threat of the Israeli invasion to Gaza was put her and also many people in a state of panic and fear. But she is okay. For me, you see, my sister and other people are only the feelers in which I can tell you what is the public mood and where we are heading. And I tell you, today the situation, even when there is no violence from the Israelis or the Palestinians, it is relatively quiet. But people are so hopeless and so desperate. And I believe everybody now in Israel and Palestine deserve better life, and we deserve the international community, particularly from America, to intervene and rescue us.
Just 10 seconds left. If that doesn't happen, how many more suicide bombers are out there?
Well, we know what is the solution. I hope that not so many people will have to be killed before we can have peace. I hope that not so many lives will be wasted before we can live in security and in hope.
Iyad Siraj, director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in the Gaza Strip, thank you for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure, sir.
Scott Anderson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.